Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery. And that is why the Machinery Digest exists. A no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello, my friends, and welcome back to Idle Chatter. I am your host, Ray Bohax, the dryland farmer from Hackettstown, New Jersey, on Cat Swamp Road. So, hey, it's been an interesting week over here in Warren County. We had a pretty good snow dump last week, shortly after I recorded the show. Matter of fact, when I was just finished recording the show last week, the power blipped out for a second or two, and I don't think that was too good, but anyway, it didn't seem to affect anything, because I already had recorded it. I got to try to figure out what would happen if the power got interrupted while I was recording, but hey, it wouldn't be the end of the world, so I would just have to do the show over again. But you know, with something like this, because I know what I want to talk about, I make myself a couple of crimp notes, as cheat notes as far as an outline. I scribble it out, but in essence, I know what I want to talk about and what I want to deliver and how to deliver it. But, you know, it's like when you, if you ever put a motor in the car or you planted a field, or obviously you planted a field, but, you know, lots of times, the second time it never comes out as good as the first time. And, of course, you try too hard or it just doesn't, you know, just doesn't come out the same as it did the first time around. But hey, that didn't happen. But we did end up having, I'd say, probably a little bit more than a foot of snow. And we had a good deal of ice here. And that caused quite a bit of havoc in Warren County. There was a ton of power lines down all over the place. We did eventually lose power. And we lost it sometime overnight. I believe it was Monday night into Tuesday, or Tuesday into Wednesday. I really don't remember anymore. The days all seem to blend into one, but I woke up at about 3, well, I knew it was 3 o'clock in the morning because I went and got my wristwatch. I woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning and the power was out. The clock wasn't working, so I knew the power was out, and so I don't know when it went out, whether it went out at, you know, 5 minutes before that or 5 hours before that. We went to bed probably about 9:30, my wife and I. So it could have been out for quite some time. Based upon how warm it was in the house, I don't think it was out too long. And then it came back on, thankfully, about 11 o'clock in the morning. I was plowing the snow, and I have the garage open, and I have a little nightlight that I put on in there in case the power ever goes out and I'm outside, so I can tell the power came back on. And I was plowing, and I all of a sudden happened to look into the garage and saw the nightlight on. But I did run our generator for the first time to power the house, which we invested in last year, and that worked very, very, very well. It's a Briggs & Stratton 10,000 watts, and I have a whole house transfer switch. So all I have to do is plug the generator, it's got electric start, and plug the generator into, basically take the transfer switch and kill the utility power, move it to off the lever, start the generator, plug the cable, and then move it to generator power on the transfer switch, and the whole house is powered up. So that worked quite well. And I had a chance to, I did obviously test runs prior to that, but, you know, never had the real McCoy, and the power was only out, like I say, for a few number of hours, and I ran the generator for about 2 hours, so it wasn't too much, and then the power came back on. But around here, there were people without power for 3 or 4 days. And actually, the one main road, Route 517, we were on Cat Swamp Road and 517, and 517 was actually closed for a couple of days because there were so many power lines down. So it was kind of a little bit of a fiasco going on here. You know, and interestingly enough, it was probably akin to like a, not as bad as a tornado out in the Great Plains or the Midwest, where it hits one area and doesn't hit another. Because if we had about a foot of snow, about 6 or 7 miles away, they had about 4 inches of snow. But it wasn't really the snow that got everything. It was the ice. We probably had about an inch of ice. We had snow, ice, and then snow. So, hey, I got a chance to check that out, and it worked out very well, thank God. And we still have plenty of snow and ice on the ground. It was supposed to melt by now, but that did not happen. So, c'est la vie, right? That is life. And hopefully, it's supposed to be 54 degrees today. I just looked at the thermometer before I came down to record the show, and it's 38 degrees. So, that's a far cry from 54. But it is raining and foggy, so it's eating up some of the snow. So hopefully you guys have some better weather and then lose power out by you. The other thing I wanted to, I always forget to touch on, is that my Hot Rod Farmer Minute is on my website under podcasts, and it's also played every week on Ag News Daily on Thursdays, and then on Wednesdays a different episode is aired on the Moving Iron podcast by Casey Seymour. So you could check that out, or you could go to my website and check those out also. I would greatly appreciate it, and I think that you will get great value from it. So they're tight. I read them because I don't want to ramble on for 2 hours, so it would have to be a tight time frame, and I think I'm enjoying doing them, and hopefully, God willing, you're getting value out of them. That's what my intention is. So that is that, and let me see what else. I bought a weather station, and I had a very good and excellent rain gauge, a RainWise certified rain gauge wireless. I just had an inexpensive indoor-outdoor thermometer, and the indoor-outdoor thermometer was accurate. I had a number of them over the years, but this one, something's wrong with it. It sucks batteries. I mean, you can't go more than 2 weeks without killing all the batteries on it. So I invested in a Davis Vantage View wireless weather station. I'm very excited about it. I'm hoping for the snow to melt a little bit more so I could get the tripod stand out and then get that Vantage View set up and brought into the house, and I could be have a lot more data for the farm here and just for living out in the country than I would with the rain gauge and the cheapo thermometer. So hopefully maybe tomorrow or the next day I can get that up and running if I could get the snow melted. But hey, we'll see what happens. It gets up when it gets up, right? But the other thing that I wanted to talk to you about is that I want to welcome you to this week's Bushels and Cents. And we did it last week for the first time. And this will be the second week, and it's going to be a segment that I'm going to add to the show in the beginning of the show every week. And the reason why I'm doing it is I want to truly drive home the message that success on the farm or ranch, it's always the ranch also, is a three-legged stool. Agronomy, or animal husbandry, as I always say, marketing, and machinery. And I felt that the best way is to take real-life scenarios and establish to you, my listeners, how a poor decision or inaccurate diagnosis of a machinery issue costs your operation money. And as I said last week, and I'm always going to say, is that I want to close that gap as far as your machinery is concerned, and close, metaphorically, close that farm shop door so those profits don't go flying out. But instead of referencing the potential loss in dollars, I will make a reference to it also at corn at $3.50 a bushel. And I know that, you know, everyone that's listening, we have a very eclectic audience all around the world, all different crops. I know that everyone doesn't grow corn. So please, you know, convert the example to your current prices for the commodity crop you raise. So if you're an alfalfa guy, if you're a sugar beet guy, you raise table grapes, you'll get the idea. I can't go through here and make a reference to 500 different crops, but you understand what I'm talking about. And never forget, it's not what you make, but what you keep. So this week's bushels and cents, C-E-N-T-S, because it's bushels and money, right? And here we are. So you do not believe that it is necessary to use a lubricity additive with ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel. At around 120,000 miles, your diesel pickup bucks once and suffers a loss of power, and the service engine soon light comes on, the dreaded SES light, right? The truck will now not go above 20 miles per hour. You get it towed to the dealership, and they tell you that the common rail pump is shredded internally and put metal in all of the fuel injectors from a lack of lubricity. The repair bill is $8,000, or 2,856 bushels of $3.50 corn, all because you did not want to spend 5 cents per gallon to treat the fuel with an additive. Let this not be you. Alrighty, so chew on that. Think about that and see what the and always when you look at anything on the farm, compare it to your crop. How much crop? If you had a combine and it was set wrong and you were putting 2,800 bushels of corn onto the ground as you were harvesting, you'd jump out of it and make some sort of connection, all right, or some sort of correction. But what I've seen, though, is that people in the farm shop think, well, that just happens, or the pump goes bad, the thing blows up, this happens, the transmission goes, all right, and most of the time, those parts are not are murdered. They do not die. So enough said. Now, today's show, what I'm going to be talking about, is the lowly radiator cap. And, not much thought is given to the radiator cap on most equipment. And you could have a radiator cap today. Well, its proper term is called the pressure cap, not the radiator cap, because many times today the system has what's called a surge tank or a degas bottle, and that is the highest point in the cooling system, and that is where the cap would be for the fill point. But we'll still call it a radiator cap, even though it may not physically be on the radiator. And, we've all seen over the years the radiator caps, and they usually say to them, never open when hot. So that's never open when hot under pressure. That's our litigious society, right, that we need to be able to tell people not to do something when they should know that by common sense. But there is a great misunderstanding about the purpose of the radiator cap. And as we are now going into the winter season, people think of a cooling system and cooling system issues predominantly in the summer. And a cooling system, like most pieces of a machine, an engine, are stressed in temperature extremes. So extreme hot and extreme cold. And so the cooling system is challenged in a different way in the cold weather than it is during the summer in the hot weather. So, and the radiator cap, the pressure cap, is a key component of the cooling system, but most people give it little to no thought whatsoever, and it's basically totally ignored. And a lot of cooling system problems that appear to be complex are rooted in that pressure cap. So I felt that it would be time for us to spend an entire show on that, because I do get a lot of cooling system questions. And even though I did a show a while back in the archives about a whole cooling system overview that I felt it was important for us to now go back, not every week, but go back over time and break those different components of the cooling system apart. And then you really do a deep dive into them where you could not do in a generic show. So, you're going to find every liquid-cooled engine today, regardless of the application, is going to have some sort of pressure cap. And that basically started after World War II. Prior to World War II, we used to have an Oliver Row Crop 70 hard par when I was a kid. There was a tricycle with a Continental engine in it. We actually, when my family bought the farm, my grandparents bought the farm in 1954, that tractor was on our farm already. And Mr. Pyle, P-Y-L-E, owned this farm, and my family bought it from him, and the tractor came with it. It was a 1937 Oliver Hart Parr Row Crop 70 tricycle, with a three-gear transmission, and that was the first tractor I drove as a kid. I mean, you learned very quickly to, when you held that steering wheel, to hold it with your thumbs up, because if you hit a rock in the field, the tricycle wheel would whip, and that that steering wheel whip like a propeller and rip your thumbs right off. But anyway, so that tractor did not have a pressure cap. It had a cap on the radiator, which was more of a lid to keep the coolant in, so it wasn't sloshing out so you could fill it up. But it did not have any spring and a gasket, and it had a gasket to stop it from leaking. But it did not have any means of building pressure. And we have to understand that a liquid, when it is heated, it expands, and that is why there is a pressure cap, because as the expansion comes, it has to be able to have a safety valve. And we're going to get into that a little bit. I don't want to get ahead of myself here with this. But there's two types of pressure in a cooling system. And, you know, I want to make this simplistic. I don't want to get mired in physics, but there is a physics component to it, and I want to basically touch on it enough for you to understand. And as, you know, as I go along with Idle Chatter and go along with my website and the Hot Rod Farmer Minute, I want to draw you to a higher level of understanding and a higher level of knowledge. So lots of times I may discuss something or go to a level that is beyond what you truly need to understand, but will give you the foundation to be able to apply physics and theory and science to different things on the farm, your machinery, but other things also. So it's, you know, education is never lost. But I also don't want to lose focus of the fact of the purpose of Idle Chatter is to make you more efficient in your farm shop and to bring a level of efficiency and reliability to your equipment so that you can have a greater level of profitability. All right, so the liquid in a cooling system is raised in pressure by expansion through heating, and that is called vapor pressure. And via the resistance and flow through the engine cooling jackets, radiator, and water pump. So there's two components there that are actually raising the pressure in the system. It's the heating, it's the expansion of the coolant through heating, so which would be identified as vapor pressure, and then there is the resistance of flow, which is hydraulic flow, which is like a hydraulic system or a garden hose. There's the resistance of flow through the cooling system. Now, if you look at an engine, the coolant goes through the cylinder head, goes through the block, water pump, heater core, radiator, and it's making twists and turns. It's making right angles. There's frictional flow losses through the engine because of the castings. There's different size passages. So the coolant system pressure, that is the pressure, the cumulative effect of the pressure, is from the expansion of the coolant from heating, but also the opposition to flow through the engine. So think of a garden hose, right? If you have a garden hose and you turn the hose on, you have no nozzle on it, then you have a lot of flow, but you have no pressure. If you now put a nozzle on it and you open up the nozzle a little bit, you will have not much flow, but you will have a high pressure. So it's a pressure-flow relationship, just like a hydraulic system on a tractor or any hydraulic system. A braking system is the same thing, hydraulic braking, right? So the thing is that, but you need to recognize that the pressure is also created in this system because of the restriction in flow. And a fluid does not like to make turns. So whenever you ask a fluid to make turns or go to a smaller hole than to a larger hole, it's going to affect its flow rate. So these two different effects are cumulative, and they will result in the pressure that is held in the cooling system or created in the cooling system. Now, years back when the radiator was vented to atmosphere, pressure was created, but to a lower level since it was allowed to escape. So on the old Oliver, we had a cap on there. It was had a gasket on it. So as I said, so the fluid didn't come out. We used to run water in it. All right, so the water didn't come out, but there was no way for it to maintain pressure. And the pressure would, in all intents and purposes, leak out. And you could open that cap when the engine was hot because there was no real vapor pressure built. And the amount of pressure in the cooling system, because at that particular point you idled the engine down, was only from the flow restriction of going through the different parts of the system. So So what I want to discuss today is we're going to be concerned only with the pressure from thermal expansion, also known as vapor pressure. And then the movement of the coolant through the engine passages is deemed as hydraulic pressure. So there's vapor pressure and hydraulic pressure, just like a hydraulic system. But the pressure cap we're going to discuss today is we're only going to talk about the thermal expansion, the vapor pressure. But as you will see as we get along into this, is that it has something to do also with the hydraulic movement, not the hydraulic pressure, but the hydraulic movement through the cooling system. So for you to understand, and understanding anything in life, understanding is the key to it, because so many people try to go to school, they go, well, I don't care what it is, and they try to remember something, and there are things in life that you got to remember, and you have to, but the fact of the matter is, when it comes to most things mechanical, you need to have an understanding, and understanding is paramount to success. And then remembering stuff, remembering fire orders, remembering specifications, remember a spark plug gap, what have you, that's what books are for. Alrighty, so, and as I always said, if you do it often enough, you can remember the spark plug gap, and that you can remember the firing order, but the thing is to understand. So to understand why the cooling system is pressurized, you need to look no farther than your kitchens, all right? And if your wife has a pressure cooker in there, that's going to be our example. What a pressure cooker does is allow food to be prepared quicker and with less water, since it operates at a higher temperature. But how does that pressure cooker achieve that? All right. So we use the word pressure cooker, and that's going to be a key here. So I'm going to bring you along this way. So now, for basic physics, whether it's the radiator on your tractor, your car, or the pressure cooker in your kitchen, on your kitchen stove, for every 1 pound per PSI, for every pound of pressure over atmospheric pressure, a liquid's boiling point is raised 3 degrees Fahrenheit. And I should have done the conversion for the people around the world for Celsius, and I apologize for that. I just thought of that now. But anyway, it's raised 3 degrees. I'm so used to thinking English. 3 degrees Fahrenheit. So whereas water will boil at around 212 degrees at atmospheric pressure, if it is exposed to 15 pounds per square inch, and that's a common radiator pressure cap rating years ago. Now we have caps up to 21 pounds. We'll discuss that at the end. But 15 pounds was more or less the industry standard. The boiling point will now be 45 degrees higher because it's 3 pounds of 3 PSI times 15, 3 pounds per square. Excuse me. It's 3 degrees for every. I don't know what I'm doing here. All right, for every pound of pressure, it's 3 degrees. So it's 3 times 15. So we would raise the boiling point 45 degrees. So now, if you had pure water in a cooling system and you had a 15-pound cap, the water would boil at 257 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 212 degrees plus the 45. All right, so 1 pound of pressure raises the boiling point 3 degrees. Now, we also have to consider that altitude comes into this. So altitude is going to determine the boiling point. That's why if you were to ask your wife when she's looking at a recipe and you live high up in the mountains of Montana, that they usually say a different cooking time. And so altitude will raise this, all right, or impact this. I shouldn't say raise it. At higher altitude, there's less atmospheric pressure, so water will boil quicker than a lower temperature than 212 degrees. So the higher the elevation your farm is from sea level, the lower the boiling point of any liquid, not just in the radiator, and it's whether it's in the kitchen stove or in your engine. And this is due to less atmospheric mass on that liquid. Remember that air has weight to it. And atmosphere has weight to it. The way God made us, we do not feel it, but atmosphere has weight to it. So the higher up you are in altitude, that the water there may boil at 206 degrees instead of 212 degrees. Alrighty? So keep that in mind. And that's why years ago, when they had back in the 50s and 60s, when they didn't have they had more of an open cooling system, they had a pressure cap, but the guy would go up the mountain to Colorado, Pikes Peak, on a hot summer day, and you have to add coolant. They would spit the coolant down when he got there because the boiling point was lower at the top of Pikes Peak than it was at the bottom of the mountain. But heat transfer, and that's what the coolant is for. Remember, the coolant is to the radiator does not cool the engine. The liquid cools the engine, and the radiator takes heat from the liquid. So heat transfer from any engine to the liquid is based on a temperature differential. A higher boiling point allows more heat to be removed from the engine due to the larger spread, the differential, between the ambient temperature and the coolant in the radiator. So just remember, basic physics, we all know this, hot goes to cold. So that the heat transfer, so the higher the boiling point, the more heat that you could take out of the engine. And this is where people get confused, because you want a coolant that boils at a higher temperature, because the amount of heat transfer, once it goes from a liquid to a gaseous state, it ramps down dramatically. All right, so if you know, I always tell people, and I did a podcast on this about opening the hood about heat soak and the detriment of heat soak on engines and electronics. But you know, when you open the hood and expose a hot engine on a 90-degree day and do the same thing on a 30-degree day, in 5 or 10 minutes, the engine will be much colder, right? Empirically, we notice on the cold day than in the warmer one. So if you were to take an engine, and let's say it's running at 220 degrees liquid temperature, and you shut it off on a 90-degree day, and you come back and measure the temperature of that engine, it's going to be hotter than if you had the 220-degree coolant, opened the hood, and came back in 10 minutes on a 30-degree day, because hot goes to cold. So the amount of heat transfer is going to be linked to the temperature differential between the atmosphere and the liquid. All right, so as we said, you know, hot goes to cold, and as the atmosphere becomes hotter, then there's less thermal transfer. So we have basically, in essence, what we have here is that we are using the pressure cap to raise the boiling point of the coolant. And if we raise the boiling point of the coolant, then what will happen is that we make it more of an effective medium, because if we had pure water at 212 degrees, arguably, inside the cylinder head, it would turn to a vapor and it would no longer have any heat transfer. And what would happen is the temperature of the cylinder head casting would keep going up due to the combustion, but at 212 degrees, the amount of heat transfer would, the effectiveness of the heat transfer would be greatly diminished. By putting a 15-pound radiator cap on there, 3 degrees for every pound, we raise that temperature, the boiling temperature, to 257 degrees. So now that water in that engine becomes an effective coolant medium to pull heat out of the cylinder head, which is the hardest part of the engine to cool, out of the cylinder head. And why it's the hardest? Because the combustion event happens there and allows for more heat to be pulled out of the cylinder head so that the engine doesn't suffer from thermal stress. All right, so that is the purpose of the pressure cap. That's main purpose, number one. But there is a second purpose to the pressure cap that we need to recognize. And the other purpose of a pressurized cooling system is to move the coolant through the cylinder head. Now, what is going to happen is that under high engine load, and a lot of people don't understand this because they don't see a change in the temperature gauge, but under high engine load, the coolant will actually boil at the contact point around the combustion chamber and become a vapor. And whether this is water, 50-50 ethylene glycol, and water, 50-50 propylene glycol water, any type of coolant, at one particular point, it's going to reach its boiling point. The ideal is to push the boiling point up as far as possible so that you could remove more heat from the casting. But under load, the thermal load on an engine is transient. So in other words, Let's say you're pulling a load of grain to town in the semi, and you get nice flat land, and you're going, and you're going 65 miles per hour, and now you come to a long grade. Maybe it's 65 miles an hour to pull that load based upon the weight of the truck, the rolling resistance, the aerodynamic resistance, the weight of the load. Let's say arguably that engine needs to make only 150 horsepower to move that load at that speed. All right, so that's all wonderful, 150 horsepower. So you're using the amount of fuel to produce 150 horsepower. And then also, what happens inside an engine, the combustion event, actually is a chemical to mechanical energy exchange. So the burning of the fuel, the combustion event, takes chemical energy, which is in the fuel, it's heat energy, which we register as BTU, it's a caloric value, British thermal units, and we take that, and then it's converted to mechanical energy of driving the piston. So now you come, and you're coming to this long grade, right? So I'm not saying downshift or anything. You're coming to this long grade, and now you have to pull the semi loaded with grain. You have to move the semi up this long grade. So now, all of a sudden, this engine needs to make 350 horsepower. To maintain a speed that you wanted with the semi, go to maintain your speed 65 miles up this hill. So now the engine is using more fuel, and if it's using more fuel, it's going to have a hotter combustion event. All right, now this is not to be confused so much with exhaust gas temperature, because we're reading this in the cylinder, because somebody can say, oh, yeah, hot rod farmer, I don't know what the hell he's talking about, because I can watch my EGTs and they don't go up that much. They go up a little bit, they don't go up that much. But you have to remember what you're reading in the exhaust gas temperature on any engine, gasoline or diesel, is the residual heat that was not used to expand against the piston. All right, so. But now if you're climbing the hill, the engine needs to make 350 horsepower. It's burning more fuel, and it's putting more heat into the combustion chamber, and the more fuel allows for a more powerful expansion event and a higher rate of chemical to mechanical energy exchange, and the truck goes up the hill. All righty? So when this is happening, when you're cruising down the road, flat land, but staying with our 150 horsepower, the cylinder head temperature, the surface temperature of the cylinder head, is lower than it would be when you're climbing the hill. So now the coolant that is going through what we call the water jacket in the cylinder head has a very easy task to be able to control that temperature and pull the heat out of it, because it's acting like a sponge. Remember, the coolant inside the water jacket is like a sponge. It's absorbing the heat. So now when you're climbing the hill, all right, this coolant needs to absorb more heat. But what will go on is that at one particular point, it will not be able to absorb any more heat, because it's going to reach its vapor pressure, its boiling point, when it converts from a liquid to a gaseous state, and it expands. That's why it is called vapor pressure. Now, and this happens, any time with any type of coolant, there is a vapor pressure. If you look at even if you look at pesticides and liquid fertilizers, they'll tell you a vapor pressure of that. All right. So now, when the coolant becomes a vapor, 97%, almost 100%, only 3% of its thermal transferability is lost. So only 3% is left. So when it becomes a vapor, 97% of its ability to take heat out of that cylinder head disappears, gone. It's like a hailstorm wiping your crop out. It's doing absolutely nothing. So the pressure created by the radiator cap, right, the pressure cap, now forces the liquid and vapor to release from the cylinder head casting in the water jacket wall. It then recondenses and allows lower temperature liquid to come in contact with the surface of the cylinder head to cool it. And this goes on in the cylinder head with every liquid-cooled engine, not just the diesel, anything. Is that the amount of temperature in the cylinder head is going to be intrinsically linked to the load on the engine, which is intrinsically linked to the amount of fuel it's burning. So when a liquid becomes a vapor, 97% of its thermal transfer is gone. So it's basically hardly doing anything. So what happens now is that, you know, remember years ago when we had carburetor cars, you get a hot day or something like that, and then the car would stall. People say it was vapor lock. Well, what it basically was, it was the gasoline. The gasoline was turning to a vapor, and it was not flowing through the line to the carburetor, and the carburetor doesn't run on a vapor, it runs on liquid gasoline. So it functions on liquid gasoline since they run. And so what will happen is that if you have a vapor bubble in the cylinder, which you would get at the boiling point, the phase change of the coolant, it has the very good possibility of it not wanting to move away. So it would be like an air-bound hydraulic system. When you're bleeding the brakes, you're getting the air out, so there's a solid stream of hydraulic fluid. So if you have an air pocket in the hydraulic braking system, you know what? You have no brake pedal, right? You're pumping, it's not applying either the calipers or the brake shoes because there's no hydraulic action. Because remember, a fluid is incompressible. But what happens is that now you get this air pocket in the cylinder head because of the coolant boiled. Now, it's going to be very difficult for this air pocket to move due to the roughness of the casting, the different twists and turns in the cooling system and what have you, is all those things we discussed. So the second purpose of the radiator cap, the pressure cap, is to build pressure in the radiator so it will force the liquid and vapor to recondense and move away from that part of the cylinder. So it actually pushes it, all right? So it's like a plunger cleaning out a toilet, right? You're pushing whatever the clog is through the pipe. So the pressure cap not only raises the boiling point of the liquid, so it becomes a better sponge, right? A more effective sponge, could suck more heat out. It becomes a bigger sponge, even though it physically is not larger, but a more efficient sponge. And then it's also going to use that pressure, so when that vapor bubble, and that's called nucleate boiling inside the cylinder head, so when that nucleate boiling occurs, that it takes that air pocket, that what's not really air pocket, it's a vapor pocket, that vapor pocket, and pushes it away, right? Like cleaning up, like taking the clog out of a sink, right? Clears away, and the new fresh liquid that is waiting behind it that was traffic jammed because it couldn't get through because of the vapor bubble there, the vapor lock thing, vapor lock, it's the same thing, it's happening inside a cylinder, that vapor lock, and it pushes it away, and then fresh coolant, meaning coolant that has not gone into the cylinder head yet, comes in. It's at a lower temperature, the cylinder head is very hot, and due to the differential between the high temperature and the lower temperature coolant, is the heat is pulled out of the cylinder, and that is how a cooling system works. So it uses the pressure cap to help recondense the vaporized coolant to push it away from the site that is hot, and then allow liquid to come in contact. So let's recap here before we move on. Now, so in essence, the reason for the pressure cap is to raise the boiling point of the liquid 3 degrees for every PSI. I'm going to put my tongue back in my mouth, right? And 3 degrees for every PSI. So for every pound of pressure over atmospheric, you will raise the boiling point of the coolant 3 degrees. And the coolant will boil at a lower temperature the higher the altitude, but the 1 PSI 3 degrees stays the same regardless of the altitude, all right? So it's just the boiling point of the liquid, but the pressure will raise, 1 pound of pressure will raise the liquid boiling point 3 degrees. So that's the one purpose of the pressure cap. The second purpose of the pressure cap is when the engine is under load and nucleate boiling occurs in the cylinder head because of the superheating of the combustion chamber, surface temperature from the load on the engine needing to produce more power using more fuel, it has more potential energy, more more BTUs. More fuel means more BTU, right? And British thermal units, it's a caloric value, as I said. And the coolant boils is that this pressure that's created, this 15 pounds of pressure, is going to be like a plunger and push that vaporized coolant away from that hot spot, that superheated spot, and allow fresh coolant to come in contact and then cool that cylinder head casting. So that is the reason for a pressure cap. Now, when you think about it, that pressure cap, and people give it no thought, right? I mean, guys that, you know, they built a $30,000 motors built, right? And they put a 20-year-old pressure cap on it. Yeah, nothing wrong with this thing. It looks good. The spring is still on it, and the gasket looks all right. Right. So I hope that you now see that there is such a paramount importance of that pressure cap in the function of the cooling system. So now let's talk about signs of a weak or failed pressure cap. And historically, they're usually weak. The spring becomes weak, and then it allows the pressure to escape, whether it has an external overflow tube or it has a surge tank or what they call a degas bottle, what have you. And as I said, the function of this is the same regardless if the cap is on the radiator or it's on the degas aeration bottle, whatever. It makes no difference. It's still, the whole idea is to raise the boiling point of the coolant and to push the coolant through the system, all right, when it is going into a boiling state. So if the pressure cap is failing, you could have these potential problems. Number one, coolant is pushed out under high thermal load. So if you have an engine, and like I said, regardless of whether it's an overflow tank or surge tank, degas bottle, whatever you call it, and it starts to push the coolant out, because even if it's a degas bottle or a surge tank, it always has some sort of escape port on it that it allows that if the fluid expands too much or you overfill it, it has an escape port on it. So if you are constantly pushing coolant out of the system, then we need to look at that pressure cap. All right. Number two, a chronically low level requiring more top-ups. Now, that kind of goes with number one, but sometimes you may not be able to see the coolant leaking or being pushed out. You may be working in the field that's pushing out and dripping or what have you. All right, so if you have an engine that all of a sudden that was chronically consuming more coolant than it normally does, and remember that phase change that I spoke about, that nucleate boiling over time will consume coolant, and that's a natural phenomena. So, but it's the amount of coolant it consumes, or that cooling system, boiling and recondensing will consume some of the coolant. That's a normal phenomenon, all right? And if the engine has worked very hard, then that nucleate boiling is taking place, and that phase change and recondensing is taking place at a greater rate. And then what will happen is that you will use boil off more coolant. So that's natural. Number three, a collapsing or partially collapsing lower radiator hose, which results in higher engine operating temperatures. All right, so now what you will do is that lots of times you have an engine start to run hot, and because the radiator bottom hose is the suction hose and the top hose is the pressure hose. So the bottom hose is the suction hose. So if you don't maintain enough pressure, and that's why lots of those hoses have a spring in them. Not all of them have a spring in them, but lots of them have a spring in them to stop them from collapsing. All right. And when the suction side of the pump is high, so it's creating a lot of suction. But if you have a radiator cap that is not building sufficient pressure, then that engine may very well, depending upon the hydraulic layout of it, may very well have a propensity to start to suck that radiator or hose closed on the bottom. And now usually that happens at higher RPM. So you could have an engine, whether it's in a tractor, whether it's in a truck, whether it's a car, and you're going at lower RPM and the cooling system is working fine, and now all of a sudden you're putting more load on it and raising the RPM or pulling down a gear. All right, you got that semi, you go and pull that load of grain right to the market, to the elevator, and you drop down a gear, and now you're running 1600 RPM into the 1300 RPM, and the engine starts to get hot, or a tractor in the field, combine, what have you. Keep in mind that as you release the thermal load on the engine, meaning that not asking it to make so much power, and that the RPM is lower, all right, then that hose will now expand back out. You're not going to suck it closed, all right? But the thing is that usually if you have a radiator hose, lower hose, that's going to suck closed because of a defective, a failing pressure cap, you could usually raise the RPM up because it's more of a function of pump speed. A water pump is a centrifugal, a centrifugal type of pump. It has an impeller and a volute, so it's more a function of pump speed. But keep in mind that, as we said earlier, that the temperature and the vapor pressure is going to affect that. So if you have an engine that is starting to run hot, and if you could qualify that it's at higher RPM and load, it's very possible that the pressure cap is weak and the bottom hose is sucking. It may not be closing all the way. It may be partially closing, which is a restriction, right? They're taking a garden hose and closing it off a little, but don't think it has to close all the way. It normally doesn't close all the way. Or it normally just restricts the flow, and then it restricts the flow and it keeps the liquid in the radiator and not going into the engine, all right? So the pressure, with defective pressure cap has the propensity to cause that. So you have an overall higher engine operating temperature without a lower hose collapse, all right? So you have no lower hose collapse. You're able to qualify that the hose has a spring in it, so it's not collapsing, but you have a higher operating temperature. Well, why would you have a higher operating temperature? Because what is going on is that you're not having that pressure, the second component of the radiator cap, to move that coolant away when it's boiling. So it's sitting in the cylinder head and boiling, becoming a vapor. And as I said earlier on, a few minutes back, when the liquid becomes a vapor, 97% of its thermal transferability goes away, is gone. So now, depending upon where that engine is reading the liquid temperature, a lot of engines on the farm have a cylinder head temperature gauge also. So they look at liquid temperature, which may be in the intake manifold or by the water pump. They look at cylinder head temperature. So the thing is that if you are not able to move that boiled coolant, that vaporized coolant away from that site, that cylinder very quickly is going to really ramp up in temperature. And, you know, keep in mind that if you constantly thermal cycle that cylinder head, because you have a high, what we call thermal excursion. In engineering, you call it an excursion. It goes up high because the cap is working. You will crack that cylinder head. And a lot of diesel engines are experiencing cracked cylinder heads. I'm not saying they're all because of bad pressure caps, but the metals today, the castings, are not as thick as they used to be to save weight. So what's happening is that you will have over many cycles, like deep cycling a battery, you will basically go and you will crack that cylinder head or drop a valve seat out, which is disastrous, all right? And then the fifth thing is, on a gasoline engine, is a propensity for it to ping or knock. Because if you have a propensity for it to ping or knock, that's usually indicative of the cylinder head becoming superheated, of the engine running hotter. So that is something that you need to think about. Now, most modern engines, years ago used to use 15 pounds, employ a minimum of 15 pounds, but you'll see a lot of engines today that have a 21-pound pressure cap. And it's for all the reasons that I said, that they want to have a higher boiling point so they can pull more heat out, make the cooling system more effective, right? And when it does boil, they want to have the higher pressure to move that coolant through that system and not to have any issues, and to have a constant flow of a solid mass of liquid coolant and not vaporized coolant in the system. You know, if you have an older piece of equipment, and it was purchased used. I mean, the guy, there was a mindset years ago with engines that, you know, if you have a leaky radiator, a weak radiator, a heater core or something, water pump, put a 7-pound cap on it. And, you know, and that's like, to me, that's like putting your finger in a vise and then popping pain pills or Advil, all right, because your finger hurts. You know, take it out of the vise. So I'm not saying that that's not a good protocol. You're broken, you're on the side of the road someplace, you're 100 miles back from the farm, 100 miles from the farm, and the radiator starts to leak or the water pump starts to leak and it's pouring out of there. You could take your 15 or 21-pound cap and loosen it up so it doesn't build pressure. And if it doesn't build pressure, obviously, it's not going to leak as great to get you home. But a 7-pound cap, which a lot of people used to put on older engines, so you buy a piece of equipment that's used or older, somebody may have put a 7-pound cap on there, and you wonder why this thing runs hot or has a lot of problems. So the thing is that, you know, keep that in mind, and then, but, and you'd want to put at least, you want to put what the factory wants, and if the engineer who designed an engine wants a 15-pound cap, you're not going to re-engineer it and put a 7-pound cap on it. And like I said, and that's the reason why people do it. They don't, they think that they're not stressing the cooling system. You know, the best way to check a pressure cap is to replace it with a new one with the proper rating. There are pressure cap checking tools. It doesn't really pay for you to invest in one on the farm. Radiator caps, pressure caps are very inexpensive. I mean, they're probably $10, $11 the most, maybe $15. So if you have an older cap, if some of those things are coming up that I said in question, replace the cap, make sure you bleed the air out of the cooling system, put the cap on there and go from there. So if this is a particular instance where it's cheaper and more effective to replace it with a known new one, good one, instead of trying to buy a $200 radiator pressure cap tester and using it once in 20 years. All right. So keep that in mind. So let's recap very quickly that the reason for the pressure cap on any cooling system is to raise the boiling point of the coolant and to help move the coolant when it becomes vaporized in the water jacket of the cylinder head, to move it away from the vaporization site, the nucleate boiling site is the proper term, and allow that coolant, because once you take that vapor bubble and move it away from that hot spot in the combustion chamber, the temperature of it is going to drop, it's going to recondense, and it's going to allow fresh liquid to come into that area of the combustion chamber. And this happens in the cylinder head. It does not happen in the block. It does not happen in the intake manifold. And it happens in the cylinder head around the combustion chamber. And it's usually more prone around the exhaust valve because that's the hottest part of the combustion chamber. But the combustion chamber is so small that the temperature differential from one side to the other is not that great. But keep in mind that this is happening, this boiling scenario is happening inside the cylinder head and what we would call the water jacket, which is a leftover term from when they cooled engines with water. All right, but it's actually a coolant jacket, so it's not a water jacket, but the industry did keep that term. So now, if you have any questions, any concerns, any issues about anything, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And now it is time for our toolbox test. And we're on test number 2, question 3. The toolbox test each week since we've started this and added this has been brought to you by Agro Liquid Fertilizer from St. John's, Michigan. And they are a high-efficiency fertilizer. And, you know, as I said to you before, and I'm saying it again, is that I'm an Agro Liquid farm. And I like efficiency, and I like to have high efficiency, and it's imperative with today's crops to get the highest yield. To not throw, the idea is to just throw an NP and K out there and loading it up and say, what the hell, throw it out there, let's go. If a little is good, a lot must be better, is not the key to success. It's not environmentally sound, and it's not agronomically sound. So what Agro Liquid is a high-efficiency liquid fertilizer that's perfectly calibrated crop nutrition. And, you know, just like we were talking about the cooling system and the pressure cap and the vaporization and the boiling point and moving, you know, properly calibrated anything. If you have a pressure cap that's not calibrated right, that all goes to hell, right? None of that is going to work, right, because it's opening too soon and not building the pressure. Well, same thing is with fertilizer. You need perfectly calibrated crop nutrition to be the most successful as far as your yield and the health of your, well, if the healthy crop is going to make a good yield, right? So I am going to challenge you. AgroLiquid is bringing to you the toolbox test each week. Don't believe me, all right? Go to AgroLiquid's website. Research over the winter what they have to offer. Contact their representative and let them tell you and explain to you. I can't explain to you here all about fertilizer. I'm not a fertility expert. I'm an engine guy, all right? But I know enough to know that if you look at the AgroLiquid program for your farm, that you will become an AgroLiquid dealer. And I want to thank AgroLiquid for sponsoring this toolbox test the past few weeks and bringing to you this information, which has nothing to do with fertilizer. But before we get into this test, as usual, we got to invite Tex Rubinowitz from Ripsaw Records in, and he is going to sing the Hot Rod Man because, hey, you know, he's got that high-pressure cap on there so he can make this hot rod music go. So sing it, Tex.
Hot Rod Man. Yeah, I'm a Hot Rod Man. Look out, little mama, gonna get you if I can.
All righty, Texas, he's hot rod that he's running. I think he told me he's running a 22-pound cap there because he wants to turn up the wick on that bad boy. He's got an old flathead Ford, right? Got a hot rod. So, all right, so we're toolbox test number two, question number three. And as I always say to you, don't be concerned whether the answer is A, B, C, or D. Be concerned with what the proper answer is. All right? So your brother lent you his one-year-old 3/4-ton diesel pickup truck to use for a few weeks while he was on vacation. You are considering buying one, so you welcome the opportunity for the extended test drive. He uses the truck for his agronomy consulting business and drives about 35,000 miles per year. When you had his truck, you used it to check cattle and go to 10 miles from your ranch to town a few times a week. A day or so before he came home, when you started the engine, the display on the dashboard said that an active regeneration was required and to drive the truck at highway speeds for 1 hour. Startled by this, you park it and wait for your brother to return. He tells you that he has never seen this prompt before in 35,000 miles, but not to worry. The truck is still under warranty, right? So the next day, your brother drives to a client's farm 100 miles away, and the truck used more fuel than normal, but everything was fine, and the prompt on the dashboard went away. You both think that the truck must have some gremlins in it. You mention it to some friends after church, and this is what they said. Okay, Farmer A says that due to how you used the truck, the diesel particulate filter became soot-loaded, and that prompted the need for the active regeneration. Farmer B, adamant about all new trucks being junk, said that is why he still drives a 1992 F-150. There's always one of those in the group, right? The clock stopped at a certain year. Farmer C claims that the system has a problem and it will come back again, maybe a loose wire. And Farmer D believes that the truck has defective or contaminated DEF in the tank. So that basically is our question. And after we get done with the special delivery letter today, we will give you the proper answer. All right, so special delivery, as always, is brought to us. They allow me to deliver it to you by Firestone Ag. Harvey Firestone, farmer, Columbiana, Ohio, grew up plowing fields and doing everything, harvesting crops. So he was a fourth-generation farmer, and Harvey dreamt of putting rubber tires on farm tractors because he knew what value it brought to cars. And his innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today and lives on with their 23-degree tread bar design tire, the AD2 technology, the IF and VF tires, and now the Firestone of replacement tracks. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. All right, so now we're going to have our letter here. And our letter is from Ralph Hartwig in South Carolina. And he writes, my older Massey Ferguson tractor with a Perkins diesel started to run rough and misfire and had a lack of power. I checked the fuel system and turbo and eventually ended up taking the valve cover off to check the valves. I noticed that one exhaust valve was very tight and hanging open. I set the lash on it, and the engine runs fine now. Should I be concerned? Well, yes, you should be concerned, Mr. Hartwig, because that is what is called valve seat recession, and the valve is actually starting to pull through the cylinder head. Now, it's actually eroding and eating the seat away. Now, why is it eating the seat away? It could be a number of things. Historically, valve seat recession occurs on the exhaust valve because, as we were speaking about the coil, it's the hotter of the two valves. And then the intake valve is cooler even to the combustion chamber, but it can also happen on the intake valve. But what I would basically do if I were you, you adjusted the valve, probably, depending upon how much you use the tractor, maybe in 100, 150 hours or so, or before, if it starts to run poorly again, pull the valve cover off and measure that valve lash again. As the valve starts to recede, which means pull through the cylinder head, it's going to close up the lash, the free play, the clearance, and that is going to be a problem. Now, valve seat recession occurs quite often because you were not good, and I'm not saying you, sir, but the person was not good about adjusting the valves. And if the valve just starts to wear normally and the clearance increases, the valve is not opening as much, and the valve itself runs hotter, and the seat runs hotter, and it pounds the seat, and it starts to create valve seat recession. So it is something for you to keep an eye on. Hopefully, God willing, that you did not damage it, that the valves probably needed to be adjusted, and that's why I did a podcast on valve adjustment. You could go back in the archives and listen to it, but that is in essence what it is. It's called valve seat recession. It's not to be ignored, and hopefully, God willing, that you were able to catch it in time and that you were able to adjust the valve and you could go many, many, many years longer without any problem. But if it starts to tighten back up again, that valve is pulling through the head and you're going to have to pull that cylinder head off and then have the seats redone on it, on all of the valves, not just that. All right, so now, and any questions, Mr. Hartwig, or anybody else of valve seat recession, as always, please feel free to contact me, and I'll repeat the email address again. It is hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. All right, so now get back to our question about the regeneration cycle. Farmer A is correct. You exposed your brother-in-law's pickup truck to numerous starts and short driving cycles, which caused the DPF, the diesel particulate filter, to become loaded with soot and not burn off with a passive regeneration cycle. And then, so a passive cycle, so when your brother took the truck back and he went on the road, it was an active cycle. The system sort of, he was driving long enough at highway speeds, and why the engine used more fuel is that during regen, it has to put fuel into the DPF, well, actually puts it into the diesel oxidation catalyst to make heat to burn off the DPF. All right, what a passive cycle is that the way you're driving the vehicle, there's enough heat generated without additional fuel being introduced for it to have enough heat for it to get at least 500 to 600 degrees in there. People argue about the number to turn the soot to ash. And that's what the regen cycle does, is turns the soot to ash. So that basically is our answer. And kudos to all of you who got it right. And if you didn't get it right, that's fine also, because now you know the answer, and that is what it's all about. So listen, thank you so much for listening. Thanks so much for being a hot hot rod farmer, and I want you to always know, and I always close this way, that a hot rod farmer, I'm pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved, beloved America. So you have a great day.